Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Media Roundtable. Today, we're going to spend the hour discussing the growing number of pro-Palestinian demonstrations and encampments on U.S. college campuses, which have been met with a police crackdown. So far, more than 400 students and faculty have been arrested. According to NPR, students at Emory University, Northwestern, Cornell, George Washington, Princeton, and the City College of New York have set up encampments as of Thursday morning, the latest to join a fast-growing list of universities. Many of these students are calling for an end both to Israel's war in Gaza and their university's investment in companies that are profiting from the war and investing in Israel. Some are also calling on their universities to end any relationship with academic institutions in Israel. The struggle has been particularly intense at Columbia University, where last Wednesday, hundreds of students set up tents on the East Butler lawn, establishing what they called a Gaza solidarity encampment in protest of the university's investment in companies that they say are helping to fund the war in Gaza. The next day, 108 students were arrested after Columbia's president, Minou Shafik, authorized New York City Police Department personnel to sweep the encampment. Now, to get the latest and to discuss the media coverage of what's going on, we are joined by two guests, Hoda Sharif, a journalist receiving her master's degree at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. Good to have you with us, Hoda.
Hi, Ethan. Great to have you.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Laura Noor Walton, a reporting deputy of audio at the Columbia Daily Spectator, which is an independent student newspaper serving Columbia and also Morningside Heights and West Harlem since 1877. She's currently pursuing a BA in history at Columbia, and her latest piece for The Nation inside the Gaza Solidarity Encampment at Columbia University was recently published as part of Student Nation, a dedicated editorial project aiming to encourage, promote, and expand the impact of a rising generation of college-aged journalists. So thank you for joining us, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, first, I just want to thank both of you and your colleagues for the reporting that you've been doing to cover these protests at Columbia. It's really become the epicenter of protests on university campuses just across the U.S. Can you give us the latest on what's happening on campus? And Hoda, let me start with you with that question.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, as you know, we're entering the ninth day now of the Solidarity Encampment for Gaza, which has been set up here on campus. It's bringing together groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, the Columbia Apartheid Divest Coalition, and leaders from the Jewish Voice for Peace. So it's really highlighting a remarkable depth in the range of, you know, not only religions, but perspectives and backgrounds within the campus community and their calls for the end to the ongoing genocides. And as you mentioned, divestment from all financial endowments and investments that Columbia has been profiting from this, and that goes towards funding this genocide. And really, for 9 days now, Columbia's campus has been buzzing with activity. More than 50 tents have been erected. As you mentioned, over 100 students were arrested. A lot of them have been released, and we've also seen the suspension of in-person classes. And so amidst these events, it's really important to highlight that there is a profound sense of community that's fostered within the encampment. I'm there every day and every night, and we're seeing students sharing stories, poems, laughter, and support. So they've really created a vibrant atmosphere here of solidarity with Gaza at this time.
And Hoda, just to follow up on that, what's the reaction been to the police crackdown on the protests? Has this gotten out of hand? Has it mostly been orderly? I'm just curious what the mood and the actual events are like on campus right now.
Of course. So the Office of the President assured the community just last night in an email that was sent out that the NYPD won't be stepping in to sweep the tents, which dispelled a lot of widely circulating rumors of the National Guard coming to campus that had invoked a lot of fear on campus yesterday and the day before. But tensions did flare up yesterday during the United for Israel march, which took place later in the afternoon just outside Columbia's gates. We saw a lot of reports of verbal harassment and inflammatory language, primarily targeting the individuals and the students located inside Columbia, who held banners reading New York Jews for the Fall of Zionism and NYC to Palestine for Liberation, among many other messages.
And Laura, just to turn to you, anything you want to add about what's been going on campus, and particularly in the wake of these arrests and suspensions?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Huda mentioned that a few nights ago, there were fears that the National Guard was coming to campus. And this was absolutely sending organizers and campers into a frenzy. But they also put out this post on their Instagram saying, you know, we need everyone to come to campus right now. At midnight, the National Guard is going to come. And we saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students show up for the encampment. And so certainly while people who are regularly protesting and who are organizing the encampment are there all the time and really committed to what they're doing, we also see a huge show of solidarity from fellow students at Columbia University who want to be there to protect their classmates, peers, friends. And so I do think that that is especially important during this time to mention. And also about the Unite for Israel march happening right now, there have been many instances of harassment. And I know that students are feeling particularly unsafe, especially since yesterday, a few of those protesters attempted to scale the fence to enter campus. And so a lot of students have been a bit worried about that. But that is sort of the latest on the ground right now.
Well, I appreciate this insight into what's going on. It just sounds like an incredibly turbulent time right now. And I wanted to ask you about the president of Columbia University, Minouz Shafik, warned students that if tents aren't moved by Friday, which is today, they're going to have to consider, quote, alternative options for clearing the area. There have also been reports of negotiations between the university and the students. Laura, just to start with you, is that accurate? And if so, what's supposed to come out of these negotiations? What would the protesters be asking for?
I mean, that is accurate. Actually, the idea was that if the students did not sort of clear the encampment by 4 a.m. this morning, that the alternative options would be enacted. But that didn't happen. There's another extension. We see that the negotiators are sort of stalling the university. And so it is pretty unclear about what the next steps are going to look like. But that's sort of the idea here. Like a lot of students are just sort of at the edge of their seats waiting for when any sort of real solid information comes out about what's going to happen next.
And Huda, just to turn to you, I want to take a step back and just ask what has sparked these pro-Palestinian solidarity encampments. I know they've been going on for at least 6 months since the war started, since the Hamas attack on Israel started. Can you give us a little bit of background about what has led to these encampments starting up?
Of course. So the latest solidarity encampment for Gaza has been sparked by a combination of factors. It's hard to point my finger at just one. Of course, the urgent need for action and solidarity has been spurring on campus for months now. One significant catalyst, I'd say, has been the ongoing hostility towards peaceful pro-Palestinian groups on campus who have historically always protested peacefully. Unfortunately, the demonstrations have been met with a lot of excessive force, you know, the use of chemicals like skunk spray that resulted in the hospitalization of several students, shockingly with administrative silence to those issues. Of course, the harassment that's also been faced by a lot of these students that are advocating, a lot of them are Palestinians, so they come from the land and they're advocating for peace and justice for what is happening in Gaza as we enter the seventh month of this devastating crisis. It's clear that students, we've reached an impasse where they no longer want to be complicit with an institution that they feel is really partaking in financially investing in these operations that support genocide. And, you know, many of these students are studying law, human and civil rights and journalism like myself. And so there is this deeply troubling feeling of a lack of equal and honest coverage surrounding this issue, and also a shock in these students' experiences who are studying and advocating for human rights. They almost feel compelled to speak out against oppression and to stand in solidarity with those who are currently suffering.
Huda, you mentioned the university's investments. Can you just give a little more detail on what they're specifically asking the university to do?
Yes. Yeah, so the demands remain just the same from these students who've been sleeping out in the cold, risking not only their physical safety, of course, academic futures and future employability. They're calling for complete and total divestment from all corporations and endowments that profit from what they say Israeli apartheid, genocide and occupation in Palestine, as well as complete transparency for all of Colombia's financial investments. And of course, amnesty, you know, for all the students and the faculty that were wrongfully disciplined or fired just for standing in solidarity with Gaza during this time.
And Laura, what do you make of the media coverage as a whole? Is it accurate, or are there common misconceptions that, you know, based on your on the ground reporting, you know, you might find frustrating because it's not accurate? What are you seeing, a disconnect, or what's your general take on the general national media coverage of these protests?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know that a lot of organizers are feeling very frustrated with the way that media is covering the encampments. I spoke to an organizer named Sarah the other day, and she told me that she's troubled by the fact that there's far more interest in what happens at Ivy League schools and the free speech debate and the arrest of protesting students than there is for what she calls a completely unprecedented genocide. From everything I've witnessed, the encampment has been peaceful, and Gaza has been really at the heart of the activism on site. So when mainstream media is not covering the carnage in Gaza, it's actually really failing to capture a fundamental part of the student movement happening right now. I know organizers who feel the need to reiterate every single day the reasons for why they are camping, which includes the fact that Israel has killed more than 34,000 people in Gaza, displaced 1.2 million, decimated 62% of homes in Gaza, and also manufactured a famine. And one of the facts that I think sticks with a lot of students right now is that there are no more universities left in Gaza. So as college-age students here, that is a point that a lot I've heard people make during interviews, and that I have not really seen hit mainstream media. And so I think that is one of the ways that mainstream media has been frustrating and disappointing for a lot of people at the center of the movement.
And Laura, just to stay with you, what kind of support have the protesters received from the faculty? And by extension, what about the student body as a whole? I mean, how much consensus is there on these protests by the student body? Or is it pretty divisive right now?
Yeah, we see a lot of faculty coming out in support of students. I know some of my professors have sent emails about amending exam policies and dates, and also being there to support students. There was a faculty walkout the other day where professors and faculty came out and just to sort of profess their support for students. In terms of the general student body, I mean, there have been multiple divestment referenda that have passed through Colombia's various schools, and just recently, Columbia College passed a divestment referendum where 76% of students voted yes to divest. And so you see those numbers on pieces of paper, and you can understand that that's a lot of people. But when you see the amount of bodies at the encampment and sort of protesting and supporting the students, that number is actually really staggering. So you can't fully grasp the extent of the solidarity on campus without really seeing how many students are showing up. But I will say that, you know, sometimes I'm sitting outside and I need to go into Butler Library to charge my devices or write. And inside Butler Library, there are students who are really carrying on life business as usual, studying for final exams and talking about stuff that has nothing to do with the encampment. So it almost feels like there's two alternate universes on Columbia's campus, where, you know, organizers and protesters feel like their lives have grinded to a stop because of the encampments, and then others who everything is normal for them. And so,
this isn't the number one issue for everyone on campus. I think it's important to keep that in mind, although obviously it's dominating the news and is important to a lot of students, a lot of people around the world, of course. And Hoda, I'm just curious to get your reaction. You know, we just heard from Laura about the overwhelming student support, at least on this referendum that she mentioned. And I'm curious if you could comment on what we're really seeing in this country, and maybe worldwide, a bit of a generational divide here, if you look at the polling. And, you know, I wouldn't expect you to comment on the older generations, but at least in your generation, do you have any sense as to why there is this generational divide when we look at this issue?
Well, I not to blame the media coverage, though I think that we've seen for a very long time coverage of these protests and these communities particularly, which have often failed to capture really the essence of not only the peaceful demonstrations, but they've also perpetuated quite harmful, I would say, stereotypes and narratives, and dangerous as well to a lot of communities, not only Arabs and Palestinians, but also Jewish communities as well. a lot of these students are being called anti-Semitic, even though a large majority of them on the ground in the encampments are actually Jewish students. And one of the organizing groups is the Jewish Voice for Peace. And so a lot of them are also getting called self-hating Jews, which again is very unfair and dangerous. And I think our generation is seeing that play out right in front of our eyes, especially those of us who are in the journalism program here at Columbia, being taught to uphold the highest standards of ethics and impartiality in our coverage, and understanding that the way we frame communities really does have a devastating impact on them, and that everything we write and say and do can really devastate certain communities over others, and also create a community of misperceptions. And so one way we can accomplish this is really just ensuring all voices are heard. I think that's something me and my colleagues are trying to do right now at the Columbia Graduate School of Program, where we're seeing a lot of great coverage coming out of that, as well as the Columbia Spectator. We're seeing a lot of great on the ground coverage, and I think that that's one way that we can help alleviate this media bias that we're seeing.
So this is Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and you're listening to Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're discussing the campus protests happening all across the U.S., pro-Palestinian protesters and the crackdown against them. We're joined by two students from Columbia University, Hoda Sharif, a journalist receiving her master's degree at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, and Laura Noor Walton, reporting deputy of audio at the Columbia Daily Spectator, the independent student newspaper there. And Laura, I want to ask you the same question that I just asked Hoda, which is, do you have any thoughts about what would explain this generational divide? You know, just speaking from your generation and what you're seeing on your campus.
Sure. I mean, something that, you know, Columbia, one of the reasons why I applied to Columbia is because it is such a politically engaged school. And it's really, this is not the first time that Columbia has been at the vanguard of youth movements. Like in 1968, we saw students mobilizing against Columbia's ties to a Pentagon Institute supporting the Vietnam War. And also the protest movement entailed people being against gentrification in Harlem, and the two causes converged, and 712 students were arrested. In the 70s and 80s, we saw protesters at Columbia urging the university to divest from American companies conducting business in apartheid South Africa. In 2015, Columbia became the first U.S. university to divest from the private prison industry. And in 2017, Columbia also divested from thermal coal. So I do believe that Columbia is at the forefront of youth movements, that students are right now especially politically engaged given the carnage in Gaza. And so I would definitely attribute, you know, the student bodies, not just at Columbia, that's what I can speak to, but the student bodies at several universities that are coming out and mobilizing for Gaza right now. Students and the youth are particularly engaged at this moment in history.
Absolutely. Well, and then maybe there's a through line here with the George Floyd Black Lives Matter protests as well. It really feels like your generation is getting a lot of experience protesting for better or for worse. I want to ask you both about what it's like just to cover this moment on a campus right now. It's like, as I mentioned, it's such a turbulent time, and you're both right in the middle of this. So Hoda, let me start with you about that. What has the experience been like for you so far?
So, of course, it's been incredibly, you know, I would say enlightening, moving, but also very confusing. It's definitely been a difficult experience. You're seeing this community that has, a lot of them have family in Gaza. A lot of them have been personally impacted by what's been happening. But, you know, as reporters, and I'm sure Laura can also speak to this, building these connections with those who are staying in the encampments, hearing their stories and understanding their struggles firsthand, it's been truly moving. You know, many of them understandably harbor this distrust towards the media, which really underscores the importance of approaching these stories, especially coming out of these encampments across the country, with a lot of sensitivity and care. Again, it's been inspiring, I think, for my colleagues and I at the graduate school to witness, you know, the outpouring of solidarity for a cause that so many have been, you know, championing for years, both on and off campus, and seeing students come together in such a peaceful and resilient manner to advocate for something that they truly believe is wrong, has been nothing short of riveting. And to be a part of this movement, especially in, you know, the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism program is only 1 year. So to be a part of this movement and to be reporting on it is definitely something that I think it will be unforgettable.
Absolutely. It's quite a way to start a career. I know you're getting your 1 year master's degree there, but this is quite an experience that you're having. You know, I'm guessing somewhat unexpected. And Laura, same question for you. What are you experiencing trying to cover this moment on your campus?
I mean, I agree with a lot of what Huda just said. I will say also that as a student journalist with, you know, full access to the university, because the school has really enacted several restrictions. People cannot enter school if they're not affiliated with Columbia University, even if they have a valid press badge. And so it does feel like, you know, student journalists in general have a sort of a journalistic duty on their shoulders to be constantly documenting what is going on the encampment because of this full exclusivity and access that we have, the fact that we can come in and out of campus as we please. And I know that many student journalists have been staying up for very long hours, sacrificing their sleep and their work because they understand that this is a privilege to be able to document. And they're really able to grasp this historic moment at Columbia University. So I do feel very honored to be able to report what is happening here.
Well, you're certainly in a really critical position. And Laura, what you mentioned, the restricting access, why is that?
Minouche Safik, the university president, does say that it is for to ensure student safety on campus. I do know several journalists who have come to the university with valid press passes and who've been denied entry. They feel like they're not able to come in and document what's going on at Columbia, which a lot of people see as sort of an affront to press freedom in a lot of ways, even though Columbia is a private institution. And so that's certainly something that's going on for apparently in the name of student safety, but in a lot of ways also preventing journalists from coming in and documenting what is going on.
And I'd like to hear from you both what your plans are for future coverage on this issue. What are you planning next in terms of your journalism? Hoda, let me start with you with that question.
Yeah, so I've been covering this community, you know, Palestinian Americans for and Arabs as well for, you know, since October. So I'm definitely planning to continue reporting on this community and other vulnerable communities who, you know, have long borne the brunt of kind of not being in the media spotlight as much as I feel they should be. And, you know, being a part of, as I mentioned, these historic moments that will likely go down in history and in our collective conscious is something I'm also feeling super honored to be a part of. But yeah, I think next up, I would just like to continue kind of advocating for, you know, decolonizing our approach to reporting on the Middle East and, you know, sharing the stories of the people who are actually suffering rather than what we think should be the narrative or anything that's kind of brought about through political agendas. I think it's important because we've seen the dangers and the way that it can play out on communities. And I think we just need to stop framing, you know, events in our voices and center communities. And as those in the encampment are saying, they don't want the protests to be at the forefront. They want Gaza to be at the forefront of the news because this is what they're doing it for. And so that is kind of the trajectory that I see my path taking.
And Laura, for you, what's next?
Yeah, I mean, right now we're still seeing the encampment in full force, very robust, people sleeping in the cold, people saying that they're not going to move until their demands have been met, chanting, I believe that we will win, I believe that we will win. And so I am going to be there until the encampment ceases to exist, and I'm going to continue to document. Right now, it's not about specific projects that I'm working towards as much as it is just making sure that everything is being logged. And recently, I just reported for The Nation, and I had so much extra content that I was able to produce an audio segment about the first 33 hours in the encampment. So right now, it's not about, you know, certain stories that I'm focusing on as much as it is, like, how can I capture best what is going on at the encampment? And as Huda said, I really always want to be bringing the story back to Palestine because that is at the heart of the protests. And it's really why the encampments are happening in the first place.
And Laura, before I let you go, we did have a question from a listener who asked if outside media are asking you as a Columbia student journalist for input on their reporting, given your access to these now restricted areas.
Well, I have received interview inquiries, and I did actually interview with a mainstream media outlet, and they didn't ask about, my coverage as much as they did. They just wanted me to tell them what was going on there as a student. So it wasn't really in the capacity of a journalist, but I did tell them that a lot of people were troubled by mainstream media coverage and did want mainstream media to sort of rectify the way that they are framing the encampments. And I was disappointed to say that they did not include that in the interview that they actually aired. And so while they are asking me questions, I'm not sure how receptive they are to my answers.
Well, maybe a good lesson for you and your journalist career in terms of how you are, once the tables are turned and you're interviewing people, to keep that lesson in mind. And I just really appreciate both of you coming on and giving us this insight into what's happening on the campus there. That's Hoda Sharif, a journalist receiving master's degree at Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, and Laura Noor Walton, reporting deputy of audio at the Columbia Daily Spectator, the independent student newspaper. Really appreciate both of you joining us here on Your Call to talk about what's going on, and wishing you best of luck with your reporting to come.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ethan.
And stayed with us on Your Call's Media Roundtable. We're going to be talking more about protests and the crackdown movement on protests in general across the United States. So stay with us after this short break. For those of you joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Media Roundtable. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org, or you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And we also want to hear from you as we continue our discussion around student protests, public protests more generally, and some of the backlash and crackdown against them. How would you like to see these protests covered by the media? What could the media do differently or do a better job in covering these protests? So you can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. So now we're going to discuss a new investigation that exposed the increasingly repressive measures being deployed to target protesters and social movements in the U.S., with many efforts specifically targeting pro-Palestine protests like what we just discussed in the first half of this show. And here to discuss latest investigation is today's guest, Adam Fetterman, who is an award-winning investigative journalist and a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. Adam has written widely on environmental policy, public lands, and corporate and police spying on environmental activists. And his latest investigation in These Times magazines investigated the wave of anti-protest laws and tactics that are sweeping the country. Adam, welcome to Your Call's Media Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
So Adam, as you heard, we spoke just a minute ago with two student journalists who've been covering the pro-Palestine encampments and protests at Columbia. I wanted to get your thoughts about the crackdown the university has begun against these protesters and encampments. What are your thoughts about what's happening at Columbia and just across the country at our universities?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've been struck by is how quickly some of the university administrations have resorted to calling in police, law enforcement, which in some cases have used pretty heavy-handed tactics to either clear these encampments or arrest, in some cases violently, as we saw yesterday in Atlanta, I believe at Emory, professors and others who were simply trying to defend the students' right to assemble and engage in dialogue on this issue. So in terms of the story that I recently published, you know, one of the issues that I address is the increasingly militarized response to protest and social movements and how that has both affected organizing and the kinds of penalties that protesters and activists ultimately face if, in fact, they are arrested and charged with, charged under some of these new laws.
And you mentioned your broader piece looking at these trends that have been taking hold in terms of protest. The piece that you wrote is called The War on Protest. Political repression is on the rise as a state finds new ways to criminalize dissent and collective action. Can you talk about what's going on with this broader trend? Give us some more details on that.
Absolutely. You know, this really kind of comes out of the mass movements around both fossil fuel development and infrastructure, particularly pipelines, that we saw in the 2010s, in particular with the Keystone XL pipeline and then the Dakota Access pipeline and the mass action that unfolded at Standing Rock in 2016 and 2017. And then sort of continued with the summer of unrest after the killing of George Floyd in 2020. And with both of these, you know, sets of mass protest, we saw states respond with new legislation that essentially enhances penalties and in some cases creates new felony charges for protest on or near what they call critical infrastructure, which can be defined in different ways, but essentially in these cases deals with oil and gas pipelines. And then following the summer of protests in 2020, we saw sort of a new crop of laws targeting protest action, engaging in, you know, blocking of traffic, which is something that we've seen again in the protests against the war in Gaza. So new laws that essentially create stiffer penalties for what are very common protest-related, you know, tactics. So it's upping the ante for these movements, and it means that protesters have to think about, you know, do I want to spend 5 years in prison for engaging in nonviolent direct action around a pipeline, or do I want to have to spend thousands of dollars because I was part of a sit-in on a bridge? Or in the case of New York State, which has proposed a law that would, in fact, make the blocking of a road or bridge an act of domestic terrorism. So these are very, very serious charges, and it certainly changes the way that social movements have to strategize in terms of the kinds of actions that they engage in.
And Adam, can you just tell us what are some of the states that are passing these laws or considering bills? And you mentioned one hypothetical penalty, but what are the specific penalties that these bills are proposing?
Yeah, it's a broad cross-section of states. I mean, I think some 300 laws have been proposed and roughly 40 or 41 have actually been passed and enacted across many, many states. I think the initial sort of wave definitely focused on states with either active protest movements targeting oil and gas infrastructure or states in which oil and gas development is, you know, a sort of key industry. One interesting example that I don't talk about in the story, but Louisiana passed a new law in 2018, making it a felony to protest on or near critical infrastructure with a potential punishment of up to 5 years in prison and a $1,000 fine. And it was a direct response to a growing nonviolent direct action campaign against, it was called the Bayou Bridge Pipeline Project. It was actually the southern leg of the Dakota Access Pipeline project, which of course had been prominent, you know, the year before in 2017 during the Dakota Access Pipeline protest. So this law in Louisiana is passed a year and a half or so later, and close to two dozen activists were promptly, I think it was 2 weeks after this law was passed, were charged under this new law with felony acts of trespassing. And it really stymied the effort to protest this pipeline, which during the period under which these activists were facing these charges ended up being completed and you know, finished. And ultimately, the charges were all dropped, which sort of reveals the fact that the actual, specific crime that these individuals are being charged with is not necessarily the point, but the point is to intimidate and undermine movements that stand in the way of industry and corporate, in this case, the oil and gas industry, of course, and their efforts to expand oil and gas infrastructure in these states.
And if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar. You're listening to Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're talking to Adam Fetterman, award-winning investigative journalist and a reporting fellow with Type Investigations. His latest piece is The War on Protest, and we would love to hear from you if you have questions about how protests are starting to be criminalized in this country and some of the backlash against them. You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send your question as an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Adam, you just mentioned a number of states, a number of different criminalization approaches to protesting. Of course, we have a First Amendment in this country that guarantees free speech. So how do these laws synchronize with the free speech inquiry? Are they going to be challenged in court? What have the courts said about what states can do to place limits on speech like this?
I mean, some of these laws have been challenged, and a few of them have been challenged successfully. But the ones that have passed remain on the books. And it's not only, sort of the new crop of laws that we've been talking about, but also states like Georgia using existing laws, including the racketeering law and also domestic terrorism laws, many of which were passed in the wake of 9/11, using these laws in sort of new ways to target protest movements. I mean, in Georgia, of course, it's been with the Stop Cop City movement in Atlanta, which has swept up dozens of activists, both on domestic terrorism and racketeering charges. So the First Amendment challenges, I would say, have certainly not deterred states from continuing to both pass new laws and also deploy existing laws in new ways to target social movements.
And legally speaking, what can local governments, state governments do to restrict speech in this case? Are there some basic tests that these legislatures have to keep in mind when they're passing these laws?
They can do a lot to restrict speech. I mean, they can make it harder simply to stage a protest in front of government property, for example, which has happened in a number of southern states in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. The legislation itself may not, in its language, curtail speech, but it effectively makes it much riskier to, for example, block a highway or engage in protest on or near critical infrastructure. So, of course, as an activist, you could still engage in that particular kind of action, but you're going to face a very difficult road ahead if you are ultimately charged with one of these new crimes.
And Adam, we're in a presidential election here. We're coming up on a summer of conventions, a Democratic convention in Chicago, where, of course, famously in 1968, there were a lot of protests at the Democratic convention there. It seems like we're in line for potentially a repeat of what happened. Of course, different issues now, but we're seeing pro-Palestinian groups that have already been denied permits to protest outside the summer's Democratic National Convention. So how do you think this crackdown on protests and at the same time this burgeoning protest movement, how do you see this playing out just this summer and in the presidential election year in general?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I do think these two trends are coming to a head, undoubtedly, and we're sort of seeing a taste of it on college campuses right now. But of course, Chicago has the largest, Palestinian American community, I believe, in the United States, has been very active in organizing against the war already. I spoke to people there who have received or have confirmed that activists in Chicago involved in that particular issue have been visited by the FBI and law enforcement in Chicago. I think, very obviously aware of and cognizant of the fact that the convention is going to be a potential flashpoint. And you mentioned that they have already denied permits for protests that would go very close to the convention site itself, which sort of sets up this potential conflict between activists and the state there. And of course, the Republican convention in Milwaukee, I think, will also encounter mass protest. And then up through November and the election itself. And of course, I do mention this in the story, you know, the rhetoric that was used by Trump and the Trump administration to demonize protesters and social movements is something that kind of amplified this new legislative landscape that we're living in. And I think gave lawmakers and law enforcement, quite frankly, the sort of the social license that they needed, or perhaps didn't need, but allowed them to kind of respond to protest movements in a much more aggressive and even violent way. So I think we are certainly in a very perilous moment, and as you say, you know, we're going to see more protests, we're going to see more efforts to stifle it, in particular because the sort of the issues that these movements are addressing are not necessarily being handled in a way that it's not necessarily changing the dynamic in terms of, for example, U.S. support for Israel and U.S. Foreign policy more broadly. So yes, these two, yeah.
And you mentioned Trump's rhetoric. Are we seeing most of these laws and this backlash against protests coming out of Republican legislators, or are there any surprising states or legislative bodies or leaders that are advocating for this clampdown?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think for the most part, they've been Republican-dominated legislatures that have passed anti-protest laws, but not exclusively. There was a critical infrastructure bill that I believe was passed in Wisconsin that actually ended up getting union support and was passed with Democratic backing. And I mentioned the new bill proposed in the New York State Legislature that would make blocking traffic or a bridge an act of domestic terrorism, and that's been brought forward by a group of, you know, so-called conservative Democrats. So I think for the most part, it's been Republican lawmakers, but Democrats are certainly jumping on board in certain cases.
And of course, universities seem to be following suit to some extent, especially given what we just chatted about with the two Columbia University student journalists. Are we seeing universities following in the footsteps of these state legislative approaches?
Well, I think to some extent, yes. And the very quick response to kind of crush these encampments and protest, I think in many ways is a sort of byproduct of the new environment that we're living in which it's sort of acceptable, if not expected, that protests will be dealt with in this kind of heavy-handed way. And, you know, the student journalists who were on earlier mentioned these rumors about the National Guard being called in, and you have, you know, the top lawmaker in the House, Mike Johnson, traveling to Columbia to sort of urge the Biden administration to call in the military. So these ideas can seem incredibly fringe and sort of crazy, but they move closer and closer to the center until it becomes acceptable. And I think that's when we find ourselves in a very, very dangerous situation.
And given what we're seeing right now on U.S. college campuses, do you expect that we're going to see even more laws restricting freedom of speech and free assembly?
We're certainly seeing governors and lawmakers make those discuss that those possibilities. I mean, for example, Ron DeSantis in Florida, I think, has already talked about enacting new legislation that would curtail the kinds of protests that can take place on college campuses. So, and obviously it feeds into this debate over speech that has already been roiling college and university campuses that conservative governors have been leveraging to sort of implement their own agenda. you know, we saw in Texas, Governor Abbott, you know, using particularly harsh measures to quell protests, I think, in Austin. So, yeah, it sort of feeds into the culture war narrative. And I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, this sort of model of proposing and passing legislation in response to protests has become almost pro forma. It's just it just sort of happens now. And the legislation models are out there. So, yes, I think we'll see more of it. And I think, quite frankly, we'll see states using, like Georgia has, using their domestic terrorism laws or their racketeering laws to target protesters and perhaps even students on college campuses.
Well, of course, we're talking a lot about state-level action and universities as well. But what about at the federal level? We've heard some federal representatives, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, for example, introduce some legislation to target protesters, to target anyone participating in a, quote, riot, as loosely defined, with some pretty stiff penalties. I'm just curious what your insights are on what's happening at the federal level, and if there's a chance that we might see legislation there that could potentially supersede or at least complement what's been happening at the state level.
I think we're beginning to see federal lawmakers in some ways copy what the states have done. You know, the Tom Cotton bill is one example, but there's another piece of legislation introduced by Marsha Blackburn and Senator from North Carolina that was in many ways a direct response to a mass action organized by Jewish Voice for Peace in North Carolina that blocked a highway. So that's a kind of a version of these state level bills that would enhance penalties for blocking traffic. And I think that is the kind of legislation that could garner more support, even potentially from Democratic lawmakers. So I would imagine that we will see more of that. And of course, the federal agencies, including the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, also contribute to this culture of fear and intimidation by, you know, opening investigations into social movements and activists and characterizing them as domestic terrorists or violent extremists, which is something that I've talked about on this show before. And I would expect to see more of, certainly in relation to the protests against the war in Gaza.
And Adam, based on the passage of these laws and your reporting, have they changed the nature of the behavior of protesters now? Have we started to see some on-the-ground impacts and even sentencing that activists have received?
I think we have started to see that, particularly in Atlanta around the Stop Cop City movement. I mean, folks are still out there protesting and organizing, but I think it has had a chilling effect. You know, this is a question that I used to ask activists all the time when I talked to them about being under surveillance by the FBI or another federal agency. And they would often sometimes say, you know, it's sort of a badge of honor. It means that the work we're doing is having an impact. But when you're charged with domestic terrorism and facing potentially 25 years in prison and a charge that's going to follow you for the rest of your life, it changes the dynamic. And I do think it has had an effect on the movement there in Atlanta, and quite, you know, the protests against the Keystone XL pipeline and Dakota Access Pipeline were remarkable in many ways, and haven't really been repeated on that scale. And I think in many of these states that have passed laws related to critical infrastructure, it's become increasingly difficult to you know, have that kind of action around fossil fuel infrastructure. So I would say the impacts are, though difficult to sort of measure, are very real.
And Adam, we're seeing other tactics that states are using, even in addition to passing some of these laws that we've been talking about. And state and non-state actors, for example, have been using doxing, where they expose activists, some of their personal information. Can you describe how that tactic is used against protesters?
Yeah, I mean, there's an extraordinary example related to the Stop Cop City movement in which activists had gathered hundreds, if not thousands, of signatures for a petition related to the police training facility. And the state or the city actually bucking their own convention published the names and in many cases addresses of the individuals who had signed that petition. It wasn't necessarily, you know, the state wasn't deliberately at least publicly saying it was doxing these activists, but in effect, that's what happened. And you know, really sort of stunned folks on the ground. And of course, you know, in the context of the protests against the war in Gaza, we've seen a number of students doxed, and you know, it's kind of changed the nature of street protest in the age of you know, ubiquitous social media. How do you protect yourself? How do you protect your identity? And what are the repercussions of being sort of outed, I guess, as an activist? It's something that I think people are probably talking about and considering as they engage in direct action.
Well, Adam, we're just about out of time. I have to ask you, what are you working on next?
Well, I'm continuing my reporting on the FBI response to both Standing Rock and Keystone, and we'll certainly continue to follow this issue related to protest, undoubtedly, as we approach both the conventions and the election in November.
Well, we look forward to reading that once that's out. I want to thank you for coming on Your Call. This is Adam Fetterman, award-winning investigative journalist with the latest type investigation, The War on Protest. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Ethan. I appreciate it.
Well, that's our show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. And you can follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio and email show ideas and any feedback you have to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Call.